So a bit of time for, let's say, clarifications, first of all, and questions. Anything that anybody wants to...
You were talking yesterday about when Shakyamuni is enlightened, and then he spends this period afterwards going through different phases of absorption and his gratitude to the three and all that. It's quite... interesting. And one of the things that occurred to me while you were talking was he became enlightened. Now, should we suppose, or is there evidence in the canon of, obviously there's evidence of his teachings for 40, 50 years, but one would assume that it was an ongoing process, it wasn't a static experience. I'm just wondering if we could, I have no particular question, whether we could explore that, it's just something that's kind of going in my mind while you were talking about that experience. Because in evolution that he's his thinking and his teaching obviously developed.
Well, I suppose you could say that tradition sees the Buddha as having attained at that moment a sort of final point. But that is perhaps rather naive. How could it be? Of course, it was a decisive point. It was a point at which he became completely free from all kleshas. So, to that extent, it was a final point. But the evidence you get in the Pali Canon, and later tradition then amplifies this, is that even around the Bodhi tree, even in the weeks following his enlightenment, he was sort of trying to muse over, mull over what it meant, what it implied, and exploring its full implications. And, that's sort of what you'd expect. It seems more realistic in a way, more true to the way life is. And then, in the throughout his career, he stuck to the same basic themes, and you see the same themes occurring again and again and again, Pratityasamutpada being the most fundamental. And a number of other themes of that kind, but you see many, many other aspects and so forth being unfolded, and especially many different ways of meditating and so on. So presumably he was all the time dealing with different people, trying to work out how to communicate with them. He's having, you know, failures and successes, and would build on those. So in that sense, I think you could say that it was never finished. How could it be?
It does seem that even at the point of the Paramahansa, that wasn't the final point either. It was the final point of the human experience, but obviously we don't know. And
Well, what he resisted any temptation to speculate about that. He certainly denied that it was a final point, but he also denied that you could think of it as something continuing. If you see what I mean, he just said, you know, you can't really get hold of this. Because it's a whatever it is, and already to talk about it as an it that is prejudging, whatever does happen to the Buddha after death, it's neither has ego clinging nor a physical body. Well, what on earth are you going to think about that? There's nothing you can think with. Do you see what I mean? Because all our categories are drawn either from our own... all our psychological categories are drawn from our own egoistic experience, and all our objective categories are drawn from our physical embodiment. So if you take away those two, what have you got to talk with? But the danger is that you then think, because you haven't got anything to talk with, there isn't anything to talk about. And that is simply another category drawn from our ordinary experience. So... it's probably safer to think of the Buddha as in some sense continuing, but you'd have to do but I have no clue what that could mean, than to think of him as not continuing. Do you see what I mean? You'd probably get closer to what happened to think of it in slightly eternalist terms than to think of it in slightly nihilistic terms. Eternalism is always a slightly better option than nihilism. The Buddha, when he talks about the middle way in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, he talks about eternalism as being wrong and foolish and so forth, but he talks about nihilism as being wrong and foolish and vulgar. crude, coarse.
I guess, yeah, for me it's the danger of I'm sure other people have this experience and they encounter the part of this, the, you know, from coming from the Catholic background, it's like the life that we're after. And
yes, indeed.
All of
yeah.
that. So,
yeah.
It's
well, I think with a Catholic background, even a Church of England background, you're in a dilemma because I don't know about the Catholicism that you received, but the Church of England that I received, there definitely was some sense of something higher. Definitely, I felt it. But it was all wrapped up in a theology that was ridiculous and a social set-up that was, Conservative Party at prayer at those days. In those days, it's the Liberal Party now, isn't it? But, just wrapped up with so much that was nonsense. Patently, a few of the priests I knew were not, living by what they taught. But I definitely felt something of a higher nature there. And I'm sure, I know that many Catholics are in that dilemma, that you do come away with some sense of a something more, but you just can't take it seriously in the package that it came to you. So I think that somehow one needs to get rid of the package, but retain something of the experience. The problem for me is with the idea of God is not the experiences that people often have that they label with God, it's the fact that the label God is problematic, easily subverted and easily encompassed by problematic social setups and so forth.
Do you think it's good when we're talking about this sort of thing to say that all of it's limited by cognition, and cognition being such a small part of mind anyway?
I think we're now going into a larger set of theories, which I think I've gone far enough with the question, if you see what I mean. Matthias.
Continuing on from that a little bit and relating to the question I had yesterday, if we talk about the historical Buddha or Buddhahood, leaving aside what the Buddha would be or what happened after Parinirvana, but from the point of gained enlightenment up till he passed away and achieved Parinirvana, if everything is conditioned and Nirvana not being something static somewhere else, meaning it's also conditioned, that would imply that when he gained enlightenment, it would still be an ongoing process of deepening until he
achieved
Nirvana. So, if he's then immediately perfect in every way, what is then the sort of evolution? Is that something we can't even describe, or is it that he's even perfecting the perfections even more?
Well, I suppose the problem is that we sort of reach the limits of our language and our experience. So one needs to have a conception of the Buddha, both after his enlightenment and after his parinirvana, which is, as it were, positive, but which is not confined by our conceptions. So do you see what I mean? You have to have a conception of a progress, which is a progress in perfection, not a progress to perfection, if I can make a distinction that way. So that you could say that in a certain sense the Buddha is deepening his enlightenment, whatever that may mean. It's probably better to think of it like that. The process is not finished. Well, sometimes Bhante has talked about this in terms of the mandala. In the Mahayana tradition and the Vajrayana tradition, you have the mandala of Buddhas. So you have a single Buddha at the centre. Initially, and then that Buddha sort of bifurcates, or rather trifurcates, and then that quinquefates, if that's a word, turns into five. And then those five, each of them begins to multiply in various ways. So he's saying that, Bhante said that he thought that was a symbol, a better symbol for what happens than the idea of a linear movement, if you see what I mean, that you're better to drop the linear metaphor or image, and think more in terms of a spatial one, of a sort of expansion in space, linear temporal, that is, and think more in terms of a spatial expansion. It's as if enlightenment becomes more and more enlightenment. So that would be a better way of thinking of it. But we are at the limits of thought, and it's best then to take refuge, the last refuge of the scoundrel, in symbols, and to sort of see the whole thing in those sort of terms, that something went on within the Buddha which was really, in a sense, incomprehensible to us, because it wasn't a psychological development in the sense that we would have a psychological development, but that something which had come to decisive flowering in him continued to flower and produce more and more petals. That's the best I can do. But you're right. If you're left with a sort of, you're impaled upon the horns of a dilemma. You either think that the Buddha hadn't got there, and that he continued to travel forward, which meant he wasn't perfect in some sense, or he'd got there, in which case, what was he doing afterwards? And it would probably try to take a middle way and sort of think, well, can't really get at it. You think of it as in some way something was becoming more and more rich, more full, more deep. Whether you could then take two Buddhas and say, oh, this one's more full and rich and deep than this one, well, we can't. They might be able to, I don't know.
Very straightforward question. I just didn't understand it. The Tiratna Vandana, is that... You said there were several, but it comes again and again throughout the Pali Canon, pieces of it. Is the collection of the text as Tiratna Vandana a Tiratna text, or does the text as a whole is from the Pali Canon in somewhere else?
No, the part of the text that's found in the Pali Canon is the, as it were, description of each jewel. Yeah? So, for instance, you've got the refrain that keeps coming back, Buddham Yava Jivatan Saranam Gacchami. That's not in the original Pali text. The part from Itipi So Bhagava Arahant to Buddho Bhagava Ti, that is in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and many other places too. So you've got this, there's a part that changes for each vandana. Of course, there's parts that change with the substitution of each jewel, if you see what I mean. But there's a part that's completely different for each vandana. That is the part that you'll find in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and in many other places.
So the text, as we're using it, is sort of put together in a Triyatna context. Is that correct?
No. Oh, no. It's a traditional text used in Theravada Buddhism. There are very many different versions of it, so it always contains some of the same common refrain, but already we've been doing four extra lines that aren't found in the one that we've been doing up until now. So you'll find slightly different versions in different Theravada contexts. I don't know much about, I haven't kind of done research into it. But yes, but the core parts of the text are found in all Theravada circles, and you'll often find, for instance, if you go to Bodh Gaya, you'll see people circumambulating from Sri Lanka, Thailand, and so Burma, and they will be chanting Ittipi So Bhagava Arahang without the extra bits. They'll just chant that round and round and round and round. It's quite often used as a sort of a circumambulatory mantra. And there are equivalents in Sanskrit, but they're not much used in Mahayana circles, so far as I know, because they tend to concentrate more on the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You clear then which is the bit of the text? Yeah. And you'll find it in all kinds of places.
I received a teaching very early on. I'm not sure whether I've misunderstood it or whatever, but it was another definition of Sangha that you didn't go into.
Sangha, yeah.
And, sorry, Dharma, not Sangha.
Dharma, yeah.
And it was basically, I was under the impression that when the Buddha was asked what Dharma was, he said, or any teaching from anywhere that overcomes ignorance and gains you insight. Is that correct?
It's a little more complex than that, but that'll do, yeah. It's said much more than that, but yes, ultimately that leads to the state of transcendence, yeah.
Right. Okay, I'll take that from there.
Yeah.
Is there any significance in the difference rendering of Bhagavato? At the beginning of the text, it's rendered as the blessed one, or the exalted one, and then later the richly endowed one, the same word. Is there any significance to that at all?
No, just that it's very difficult to find an English translation that really does justice to the sort of full emotional and sort of metaphorical character of the original. Blessed is okay in a way, but you know, it's not a term that we use very easily today. Richly endowed is quite good, but a bit flat. So it's very difficult to know how to render it. But I think that's all it is. Bante translates it as richly endowed in his poetic translation of the sutra, the Tiratanavandana. I don't know, and I think Blessed One is a very common translation. You'll find it in the... unfortunately, it's often translated as Lord, which is really pretty unfortunate in our context because of the social significance of it. The Buddha would take his place in the House of Lords, the old House of Lords.
Can you say anything more about the sort of cosmic context of the Buddha? I mean, how are we what are we to make of this mythology that there are many Buddhas in the past? That a Buddha is somebody who's rediscovered the Dharma. Do we have to take on board that whole cosmological thing, or is there some other way of reading the spiritual import of what's been got at by the mythology?
Well, I suppose that the principal thing is that you recognise that what the Buddha attained is not unique to him, even as a possibility, that anybody potentially can do what he did, and that it's not unique to even humanity. Any conscious being has that possibility. So at the very least, you're asserting that it's a potential within reality itself. As you're saying, that the Dhamma Niyama is the set of processes that are implicit in reality that lead to Buddhahood. So that those are there everywhere. Wherever there's self-conscious beings, they have the potential to gain Buddhahood. So at the very least, you're asserting that. It's much more difficult for us, of course, to assert in any sense as a sort of historical claim that there were Buddhas in the past. Traditional Buddhists believe this very fervently, and that they'll tell you, you know, this is where the Buddha, I can't remember their names now even, but this is where such and such a Buddha did such and such. You know, like the Svetogon Pagoda in Yangon, Rangoon. There are four shrines to the Buddha and the other three Buddhas of the past, and they're all said to have visited there. And they even have relics from some of the Buddhas of the very distant past. So Buddhists in the past have believed all that implicitly. It's clearly really very difficult to do that. I don't myself feel compelled to even think about it very much. I just take it that what the tradition is saying is that Buddhahood is an ever-present potentiality. Everywhere, at all times, when the conditions are propitious, that possibility unfolds. That's what I take that to be said, that Buddhahood is implicit in reality. So and I think that if you haven't understood that, you haven't really understood what Buddhahood is. You think that it's a particular attainment of that particular person, and that automatically puts you then in a funny relationship with it. But if you see it as something that potentially arises at any time, anywhere, potentially, when the conditions are unfold, then you've got what the Buddha is. Of course, the extra fact, a point about the Buddha, which perhaps does involve a certain amount of faith, and not exactly a requirement, but it's the idea of the Buddha as having a cosmic function, in the sense that he has been practicing the spiritual path through many lifetimes, and that this is his last life, that he's deliberately, so to speak, chosen to be reborn in a situation where the Dhamma has disappeared, so that he can re-establish it. It's part of sort of a perception of the extraordinary magnitude of the Buddha's achievement. Yeah. Because even if we manage to achieve the same attainment as him, we will not have achieved it under the same circumstances as him, and will not have the same virtues and powers as he had. I personally don't find that at all hard to believe, but I don't sort of require it of other people. It's certainly true that in narrowly historical terms, the Buddha appears to have discovered what he discovered on his own. From what we know of beliefs in India at that time, nothing like that was believed, was taught. The things, well, that's to say, nothing like that was taught is invite contradiction. There were teachings that, you know, you can see were sort of were what the Buddha used to speak his own truths through, but nothing that amounted to the same expression of insight, particularly Pratijasamutpada, so far as we know.
Is there a requirement to believe in the historical Buddha as taught? As taught traditionally. I'm thinking specifically of the sort of storylines for Jesus, for example. He shares so much with people that preceded him, Osiris, Dionysus, that it seems as if the historical record is Jesus is very dubious that there was such a man that followed that life story. Mm. But by the same token, when I read the myths of the Buddha, the original myths of the historical Buddha, it seems to me it's following certain storylines. I find it very hard to believe that there was an actual physical person whose life followed in that way, at least up until the 19th. So is it required that we believe in that?
Well, it depends what you're talking about. You said at least up until enlightenment.
Well, I suppose, you know, this whole thing about the palace and the forces.
Oh, that's quite definitely not historically verifiable. And indeed, it's quite clear that has been assimilated to the Buddha's later myth from other sources. So that is all pretty clear. So if you actually go back, I mean, Vishvapani brings this out very well. If you go back to the Pali Canon, which I think, by and large, you know, you can't accept all of it from a historical critical point of view. But if you look at the Pali Canon, the Buddha really says very little about his own early life. It's fairly clear he came from a privileged background, but not, you know, when you talk about Maharajas and so forth. There weren't Maharajas in those so-called, well, oligarchic confederacies. So, he was simply a part of the aristocracy of that particular tribe. That's the best we can say. And really, all he himself says is that at a certain point, he became disillusioned and began to feel that, the life that he was leading was empty. And he said to himself, why go in pursuit of things that are conditioned when you are yourself conditioned? When you are yourself subject to to aging, sickness and death, why go in pursuit of things that are subject to aging, sickness and death? So I think I think in a way you have a duty to apply a historical critical uh, um, uh, analysis to what we have. But something remains, if you see what I mean, that he was from a certain area of India, that he was from a certain tribe, a certain clan, that he seems to have come from a leading family within that clan, that he did go forth as a young man for reasons that he tells us of, and then the rest unfolds. And there's enough corroboration for the rest that unfolded to be fairly easy to accept on historical grounds. But what happened before that, he himself doesn't seem to be that interested in, if you see what I mean. And that's the position. If I talk about the Buddha, I might, if I give a life story of the Buddha, I might tell people the story of the old age sickness and, you know, the four sights and so on. But I'd make it quite clear that the first time we hear about these are in relation to one of his disciples. And the business about the palaces, they're all told of Yasho. And it seemed clearly a sort of back reading. He must have been like this. And we can tell that these stories are first told about the Buddha at a certain historical era, about 100, 200 years after the Buddha. So I think that you know, we can apply the higher and lower criticism, as happened you know, in the 19th century in Germany to the Christian documents. And what we come up with is, well, I think Vishvapani's done a very good job of revealing it, something that is fairly empty of detail as regards what happened before, although the broad outlines are there. But quite sort of rich as regards what happened afterwards. And there are plenty of places that within, you know, a living memory of the Buddha were commemorated as places he'd been to. For instance, I went to a small park in South Delhi. If anybody's been to Delhi, near the Baha'i Temple, that wonderful white lotus temple. Just round the corner from there is a scruffy little park. I mean, really scruffy little park in the middle of a, you know, a lower middle class housing sort of zone. And in the middle of this scruffy park, with no sign or anything like that at all, there's a heap of rocks. And on the top of that heap of rocks is a rock cut inscription in Brahmini, saying this is where the Buddha preached the Satipatthana Sutta, and it was done by Ashoka. So, you know, within 150 years of the Buddha's death, and it becomes a little hard to sort of, you could say they made it up, but 150 years is too close to, for my taste, to think that that's easily made up. There would be people who said, no, it wasn't. And there are plenty of places like that where, particularly the Ashokan pillars and edicts, show that within a very short time, within, you know, the living memory, as they say, those sites were recognised. So there's quite a lot of corroborative evidence. But yeah, the early detail, I think, we know almost nothing.
This may not be appropriate, yeah. If not, it'll be a one-to-one thing. The reason I think it may be is because I'm wondering there might be other people of our formation,
sure,
who wonder the same thing.
Sure,
but
yeah.
To what extent may I disagree or agree to disagree and still consider myself as a fully-fledged member of
Yeah. Well, I suppose it depends what you're agreeing and disagreeing with.
Well, for example, I still very strongly feel that there is merit, that to think of your way as better than all others for everybody is dangerous. Mm. And I actually think that, and unless you experienced everybody else's path, it's also impossible to say. So I am still of the opinion that one should be very careful about thinking that your way is the way rather than a way, and that actually, even though I can categorically say it feels like the best and most profound thing that I personally could ever have for me, in the same way that Banti says ethics is for oneself, generosity is for others, in that same sort of spirit, I would like to think that, well, I still think that there are there is value in other paths, and that we should never undermine that value, and that we should never assume that just because this is a way for us, it's the way for everybody. And that seems to be in contradiction to some of what I'm being taught, and I don't know...
Yeah. I think we'd have to have a much more careful discussion. Do you see what I mean? The way you've expressed things, I would want quite a lot of footnotes and clarifications too.
Right.
And I don't think this is, you know, we haven't really got enough time to go into that. But I think that, you know, there's as I say, there's quite a lot that one would need to clarify, so that the statement doesn't stand as baldly put, if you see what I mean. But I'm sure that many of your concerns would be met if we had a careful discussion. The question that you asked originally, presumably, was that a stalking horse for that question, or are you interested in the question
itself? I mean, there are times when, you know, a Banty will say something that I very strongly disagree with.
Sure.
Yeah. For example, women are less spiritually endowed than
indeed,
men.
Yeah.
I find the complete opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
I find that women are much more naturally... emotionally mature, altruistic, and so on, and all the things that we strive to be, and therefore they have an advantage, not a disadvantage.
Right.
You know, and so on. So, and these are, as far as I can see, these are not dharma; these are Banty's opinions.
Indeed,
and
I would say that was the case. That where that is concerned, assuming there may be views inherent in your disagreement, there may be views in his position, but assuming that there were no views that hindered progress on the path, merely saying, I don't think that women are, in any sense, at a disadvantage, it is not going to hinder you from your spiritual practice, and it's not going to hinder you from going for refuge to the Three Jewels. How you understand what the Buddha is, that is going to be a matter of major difference, if you see what I mean. Because what we're doing at ordination is saying that you are going for refuge to the same ideals as we are, in the same way as we are. So that would need clarification. I think, personally, from listening to what you're saying, I don't think that we'll end up with a disagreement. But I think it just needs a careful and slow discussion about it, if you see what I mean. Which I don't want to... enter into in a situation where I would say something, you're coming with something else that's part of the whole issue. Do you see what I mean? It needs setting out in a slow and careful way. I need to hear your full pitch, and then you need to hear mine. If you see what I mean, we need to engage them. But yes, if in the end it comes to a point where you're saying, well, I think the ideal of Buddhahood is something different from what you think the ideal of Buddhahood is, well, clearly this is not the right order for you. Assuming that everybody else agrees with me, of course, they may not. but yes, that it's really as regards the goal, the nature of the goal, the nature of the Three Jewels, that our coincidence needs to be taking place. As regards the comments about, you know, what happens in particular situations and so forth, well, that's all bound to be rather the subject to experience. And even if you say something about the relative capacities of men and women, you can't say anything about any particular man and any particular woman on that basis. But to some extent, I would say that even if it is true, it's pretty useless in the end. Interesting, but, you know, so what? And Banty himself says that. He doesn't expect you to agree with him about relatively minor matters of that kind. But where the goal is concerned, obviously, if what unites us is our going for refuge to that goal, it needs to be more or less the same goal.
Yeah, I can see that very clearly.
Mm. I don't think we're going to disagree in the end, but it needs some careful picking our way through the issues, if you see what I mean.
Thank you.
Mm. Mm. But yeah, I think we all have to face the fact that in the end there's a point of where you either disagree or you agree. Mm. There are plenty where you can discuss and debate and disagree, and the main thing is not to get too het up about that. about the minor matters. We always fall out over the minor matters. It's always the washing up that destroys communities, not not the Buddha. And of course, that's what this sort of situation is all about, seeing whether we think, we, the order, think you share that goal with us, and whether you, seeing whether you share that goal with us.
So, this is, might be a bit personal, so you can say, I don't want to answer that. But I'm thinking about the Sangha bit, so you're talking about your experiences and difficulties through it. I'm just wondering how you would sort of suggest, from your experience, how we might survive this.
How to survive the Sangha.
Some tips,
yeah. It's quite an interesting topic. Of course, there are many different ways in which people do fall out with the Sangha. Often, the most common thing is that you have an experience of being wronged by some people or some groups of people. I've seen that many, many times. On the whole, I've probably been seen as a wronger rather than a wronged. But, you know, situations occur where, somebody is asked to leave a particular job or is not elected or whatever, their point of view isn't agreed with, or somebody, you know, often fall out over sex, of course. The communist cause after washing up. Yes, something happens where somebody feels that they've been wronged, they've been betrayed, they've been let down, they've not been taken seriously, and so on. And the instinct is, it depends on your personality, but for some people, and perhaps for quite a lot of people, one's instinct is then to break off. Okay? It won't have me, then I won't, etc. I'm sorry, I'm caricaturing. But that's what one can feel, that, well, what's the point? They don't understand. They don't really share this ideal with me. And it's not a question merely of a disagreement. It's a question of a real sense of being wronged. Another thing that can happen is that you see people doing things that you definitely consider to be wrong. This arises a lot in India, where the social norms are much narrower, particularly where sexual matters are concerned. And inevitably, a lot of deviance goes on, of all kinds, because human beings are human beings. And so, if there's any sort of straying from the straight and narrow of the normal, then people can get very, very moralistic about it and say, well, in the order, this is tolerated, I don't want to be part of an order like this. So the issues are usually to do either with a personal disagreement or with some sense of moral disillusionment, or often even moralistic disillusionment, where people don't live up to the ideals or the idea of moral behaviour that is really important to you. So I think the most important thing is to maintain communication. Stay in contact, and hopefully you've maintained a wide enough range of contacts for the issue only to be between you and some people. And the order nowadays is large enough for one to have a sense that, well, even if those people are not really up to the mark, well, there are still others. And this is why we put quite a lot of emphasis on maintaining wider connections, so that, you know, for instance, you're not just in contact with people from the LBC. You go to Padmaloka, at Padmaloka you're meeting people from different centres. When you go to Gushaloka, if you do go there, you'll be ordained with people from a number of different centres. And hopefully you'll make friendships there that will last your order life. And even if something goes wrong in your connection here, well, you'll have connections somewhere else. So I think for everybody, I'd strongly advise that you kept a broad range of contact. We also think it's very important, it's something I've been debating a bit in India recently, that the person who does ordain you is not somebody who has too much of an involvement with your business life in the order, as it were. So that, you know, because what can often go wrong is that you fall out with the leading figures in your own centre or class or business or community or whatever. And you don't want those to be crucial people in your ordination. Where moral issues are concerned, again, the key issue is keeping up communication, and I think especially keeping going on retreat. One of the things I notice with those who begin to get a bit alienated from the order is that they tend to start not going on retreat with other people, not participating in activities with other people, so that the issues that divide you become very, very significant, because you're much less of a living experience of what unites you. This is very pertinent in India. So I think that the major thing is you need to work as an order member, and even before you're an order member, at keeping alive a large range of connections, a wide range of connections within the order, and keeping alive your experience of the order at its best, going to order gatherings, going to conventions, and so on. Don't let alienation in one situation alienate you from what will actually overcome your alienation. Because a particular character type, once betrayal takes place, you distance yourself. If you're of that type, you need to be conscious of it and work against it. But there's quite a lot more that could be said, and it would be very interesting. It should be really part of ordination training. What to do when it goes wrong, not if it goes wrong, when it goes wrong. Because it will. You'll find your chapter is thoroughly disappointing, you know, because you've been at Guhyaloka, everybody's really inspired, you come back, and in your chapter they're just groaning about the weather. Fill in the blanks. And, you know, often as a new order member, you're perhaps a little brashly idealistic, and it's quite disappointing. Don't smile, don't shy. Yes, and it's quite difficult sometimes to know how to integrate your fresh enthusiasm for old, tired order members who are in need of a retread. And I say there, don't lose your shine, even if you are an aged young order member. Don't lose your shine, keep that, and keep your idealism, even if it is regarded as a bit of a nuisance. Keep raising the awkward questions. So, yes, it's I've never particularly found it difficult. It's been a period of my order life when I felt that important things I had to say were not being listened to. That would be, that I say, the worst of it. And something of a falling out with Bhante at one period. But fortunately, most of the time in my order career, I've had such a wide range of connections and always very deep connections with people. And, you know, there comes a point where you think, well, I'm going to leave this order, and you think, you know, but all my friends are here. All the people I really respect and like and care about, they're here. And actually the ideals that I care about, they're here. Okay, I'm going to keep working with it, even if, and in the end what you find is that actually, you know, it's not as bad as you think. It's a good question, and I'm sure if I had more notice of it, I could probably say something more about it. Give several very long talks in which I got at quite a lot of people. Paid back quite a few months. in a thoroughly, the spirit of that. The plain fact is you will find it less than ideal, although you will find the ideal is always alight, in my hope and belief. It's a bit pertinent at the moment in India, because for various kind of historical reasons, it's going through a bit of a turmoil in India. It's very, very difficult conditions they're working under, and especially the need to change the basis on which things are funded in India has created quite a crisis, and finding that very difficult. But what I see is that the order in India continues to produce really remarkable individuals, and that's the sort of thing to keep looking at. Well, yeah, there's a load of people who are not really doing it as much as I think they should be, but look, there is so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, and they're not necessarily the people who are out front, often quite quiet people who are just pegging away at it in the background, not the outstanding ones necessarily. But it needs work, and that's why I think it's so important that you put time into engaging with the order. When you're putting time into engaging with the ordination process, and often after you're ordained you have a sort of sense of, phew, done that, can relax. But actually you need to then transfer that sort of effort into engaging with and keeping the order alive. It's a bit like we were saying about Buddhahood, you know. It's not that the Buddha, once he was enlightened, sort of thought, phew, now I can relax and go gambling and so forth. It's that a new process of unfoldment takes place, which, well, in the Buddha's case, it happens spontaneously, but in the case of a new order member, it requires quite a bit of effort and work to keep your sense of being a part of the order alive. So it's good to raise these topics. You can ask the newly ordained all around, relatively newly ordained. Report from the front.
I've got a question.
Yes, you.
If you were a lot of my questions have been answered by the previous response, actually. But if you were a bit older and you were living in London, and
my name was Peter Cogan.
Not here for me. Because I am guilty of an awful lot of the things I've seen here that you were talking about before, because I did detach because of differences and things, and I made that mistake, and I'm responsible for that. But I'm here now, and I think if you were in my position where you had a passion and you wanted to move forward with an absolute passion, but you didn't have time, and genuinely didn't have time to do all the things you wanted to do, and you weren't in a position. Or you chose not to live in a community, and you weren't in a position, or you chose not to be in team-based work livelihood, and you did, you know, you were in cohabitation, you know, with a partner for life, you know, a woman, man, whatever. What advice would you give, because the circumstances are slightly more challenging because you don't have the freedom of choice? Where would you invest your time and your effort to make maximum use of trying to move forwards?
Well, as you've defined it, what you seem to be saying is that there's nothing about your life that you can change. So then your choice is, how do you act within that life? If you sort of mean the area where you do have choice, well, how do you relate to your partner? How do you do your business? How do you communicate with other people? So do you sort of mean, as you've defined it, and I have to accept the terms of your question, which I might be reluctant to do, but I have to. Accepting the terms of your question, you have to find ways to do what you do in a different spirit. Do you know what I mean? If you're saying, I've got to walk across the room somehow or other, well, you have no choice about walking across the room, but you can do it mindfully, you can do it unmindfully. You can knock things over, you can not knock things over. You can do it with a strong sense of idealism, you can do it with no sense of idealism. You can look at all the aspects of your life and try to apply the Dhamma within them. The Dhamma is in the end to be lived in the moment-by-moment experience of life. But perhaps one does also need to think, well, is one quite as constrained as one thinks one is? I very, very hesitantly suggest that maybe some sort of examination of the terms of one's life and a question, well, am I as constrained as I think I am? And do I want to remain that constrained? and what in that life is really dispensable or changeable. I'm pretty sure that quite a lot of what one does, you know, do you really need to read the paper three times a day? I'm not saying you do, but you know what I mean? It's the sort of thing that one does. You know, like some time ago, I sort of realised I was listening to the news in the morning, and then I was listening to the news again in the evening. And think, you know, well, why? Nothing's really changed. It's just a sort of distraction. So, you know, you need to think about that. That's the time I could be just sitting doing nothing, for instance. Allowing reflection to occur. You know, and I found that I spent 8 months without any news of the outside world, and when I turned the news on again, apart from the fact that the bank that I'd invested all my money in had gone bankrupt, apart from that, nothing had changed. You know what I mean? Nothing really had changed. So, you know, you need to think about all the things that seem so important. At time you sit in front of a television, if you do. Is that really worthwhile? You know, if you watch television, are you really selective about what you watch? So I think if you examine life quite closely, even a life that seems quite constrained, could be quite a lot of fat could be trimmed from it, and it could be made. And I say that about my own life too. I need to constantly realise that, you know, I waste quite a lot of time. So cut out as much distraction as you possibly can. This is what Uju means. Mm. And, I don't think there's anything about living with a partner that is intrinsically inhibitory, especially if you're living with somebody who's a fellow practitioner, as you do. That should be, as I do, that shouldn't be inhibitory at all. Of course, you're not all the time relating as, one who goes for refuge to another who goes for refuge. But even in those situations, you can be ethical. So I think that you need to do a real stock take and just see what of what I do is really constrained. What can I change, even within the terms of reference of what I can't change? And of what I can't change, how can I do that more mindfully, more constructively, more positively, and so forth? There are plenty of examples in the Pali Canon, as we heard the other night, of people who are living full so-called lay lives, who gain everything, according to the Pali Canon, at least short of arahatva, up to and including non-returnership. Anatha Pindika, who was really a major financier involved in all sorts of banking, which was in those days pretty simple, but he was a very, very wealthy man indeed, and was the banker to the two major powers of the time, Magadha and Kosambi. Kosala. He nonetheless died as a non-returner, as a devoted follower of the Buddha, and used his time, used his money to very, very good effect. It was a famous case, isn't it, that the Buddha, it was reported to the Buddha that I think it was Pasenadi, his harem had burnt down, and all his wives, his 500 wives, had been destroyed in that fire. And it turned out that they'd all been the Buddha's disciples. So somebody came, as usual, said to the Buddha, "What's happened to them?" And the Buddha said the least of them was a stream entrant. So, and Bhante commented, "It sounds like a women's community." So, do you see what I mean? Well, in the end, well, if you can alter your circumstances so that they give you more time for direct spiritual practice and especially for direct work to help the Dhamma to spread and grow, the more time you can give for that sort of activity, the better for the world. But what you can't, then you must apply the principles of the Dhamma as fully as you can to them. All our order members in India, without exception, apart from one or two who are young but still intend to get married, all of them are married. And there's some very, very worthy people there. Exceptional people. I'd say that Sudarshan, who was killed in an accident 2 years ago, was one of our best order members. And he was married to Bodhisaki, his wife, who died in the accident with him. Extraordinary man. Very, very simple, very humble, very devoted, very, very good friend to so many people. He's a married man with a son and a daughter, and who's brought up very, very well. So, yes, obviously, it's only sensible if you've got the freedom to order your life in such a way that you've got as much time as possible for direct spiritual practice. But if you choose not to, and it's a personal matter, or you've kind of taken on commitments that you don't feel you can change, then you've got to work within those circumstances, and there's every indication that you can turn that into a success.
Within that question, I wonder, I mean, let's take on board the terms. There are situations where people can't change things.
Indeed.
But there is a gap on the diving board, or on the gangplank, as it were, where they can put something in. I mean, if we're talking about people that have asked for ordination, are there activities that you would think, okay, there's only a certain amount of room, focus on these activities?
Well, I think what you need to do is, before you take on commitments of any kind, you need to reflect upon what effect, as far as you can understand, that will have upon your attempt to practice the Dhamma.
So, well, I mean, for instance, I was caring for a family member with a fatal illness, full-time work.
Yes,
and
yes.
The idea of reading the paper was out of the question.
Indeed, yeah.
So, but within that, there's still a few hours in a week. So, I mean, that's an extreme, but without having to consider those things that have been taken on, within the gap, what are the things, if someone's asked for ordination, if their time is constrained, what are the things that you would recommend?
Given that you have some time, what would you do with that time? I'm afraid that it would be too difficult to answer that in general, because you'd have to look at the circumstances. So for some people, what I would say is probably the most important thing is to just sit and do nothing. If you see what I mean, you need time to just sort of come to yourself. But for most people, I'd say that the main thing was to keep alive some connection with the Dhamma as conceptually expressed. So you keep alive some sense of the Dhamma as a living influence upon you. If possible, some sense of the Buddha in your life as communicating to you the Dhamma. So just, if you've got very little time, take the Dhammapada and just read a few verses of the Dhammapada and sit with them. You know, sort of try to reflect upon them, live with them. If you try to keep that alive in your life. Try to keep some devotional element in your life. So something in your life that involves overt ritual expression of your feelings, and it helps to develop those. So that every day you light a stick of incense and a candle and make an offering and do some chanting. Do something every day of direct meditation practice. Even if it's only just 20 minutes of mindfulness of breathing or metta bhavana. And then, of course, keep in contact with spiritual friends. So those are probably the main elements, those four. Just some coming to yourself. Five, maybe. Coming to yourself, I think, is very, very important. If you're very strongly constrained, you need some experience of freedom and space. So give yourself something of that. And too often you reach for distraction as a way of getting that freedom and space. So just sit and do nothing. Spend some time just connecting with the Dhamma, so it's sort of a living voice in your ear. Some time connecting with the three jewels through devotion. Sometime actively working on your mind and trying to find a way to keep that as a continuing activity. And keep in contact with friends as best you can, even if it's only an email contact or a phone call, but preferably some face-to-face contact. And I think it's amazing what people can do and what people do. I've seen people under very, very constrained circumstances. One woman who I had some contact with, who was working for UNHCR in Uzbekistan, and under extremely difficult circumstances. And she said that she just constantly remembered her spiritual friends and constantly thought about the Dhamma, even in the midst of horrors around her. So it's perfectly possible. Some people seem to manage to keep that alive very, very well. It depends on, individuals. I think where the other thing is to try to bring the Dhamma to bear on what you are doing. I had a little experience of that. My mother had a stroke when I happened to be with her. She was 85 when she had the stroke, and I happened to have called on her, which I used to do once a month or so. She just had the stroke when I arrived, and I couldn't leave. I had to stay there, and I was supposed to be going to the United States for an ordination retreat, where I was doing ordinations. I couldn't go, and I remember, my mother, very confused, and also, bedridden, so she needed help to go and have a pee and all that sort of thing. So waking me up 7 times a night, and what that's like. You start to go a bit frantic, and I remember the thought coming into my head, something like, but what about my Dhamma life? And I caught myself as the words were coming out of my life, my mouth rather, coming out of my life. And I caught myself and thought, this is your Dhamma life. This is not just about your mother, this is about another sentient being, and about, compassion. This is about selflessness. So I tried to sort of work, those reflections. Not always easy. My mother was a pretty feisty lady, very demanding. Tried to make that, insofar as it, very small amount of it fell on me. But I tried to work that into my spiritual life. So I think that's, if what you're doing is not unskillful, and it shouldn't be unskillful, that's a sine qua non. If it's at all skillful or neutral, well then make it into a spiritual life and spiritual practice. Feel that you're doing that. Dedicate it to the Buddha. Every time that bell goes and you know that it's going to be a request to do something that is really not necessary, to move the pillows around again or whatever it may be, I'm doing this as a practice of selflessness. I'm doing this as a gift to another human being, especially the human being if you're parents. It's a gift to the being who gave me life, and try to dedicate it in that way. Not easy, not at all easy, and you will need other elements in your life to keep that alive. But there's nothing that is not unskillful that is not capable of being made into spiritual practice. Don't choose it if you don't have to. Choose this. Spiritual life is hard enough. Don't go and make it harder. But if you've got a choice, choose that those things that are easier, as it were, more direct in that sense. But if you haven't got a choice, well then, turn them into spiritual practice. That's up to you.